actually got this, it's the big why. I'm not going to discuss the big why today. I'm going to be discussing the big what. So, but if you find a store that has a big what as a bag, let me know. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate in this, Dr. Wimmer. As you can see, I'm kind of nervous. Nervous for a number of reasons. First of all, I think you need to understand a little bit about my perspective. I am a non-theist, okay? And in another day, in another age, you know, people would be lighting up matches on me. But and so I kindly please keep your matches to yourselves. But that's fine. I've come to sort of my lot in life, my perspective on things, through a fairly complicated process. My family is religious. My wife is Catholic. My two children were raised in Catholic schools. We hardly ever talk about matters of religion, even though I'd be very inclined to want to do so, you know, not to be judgmental, but just simply to broach the subject and have them explain to me the depths of their beliefs and how they come to them, which I think would be kind of a fun thing to do as a parent. But as you know, teenagers hardly talk to you about anything anyway. So I figure maybe in 20 years I'll have that conversation, and then I can, you know, give them my paper or something, you know. The other side of the coin is that I've been diagnosed with a terminal cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I'm in my third year of basically not having this cancer. But, you know, I realize that my time is short or long. They can't tell me which is which. You know, I'll have my train wreck in 2 years or 15 or 20. They don't know. I don't know either. They're not doing anything about it. I'm not doing anything about it. You know, and for a non-theist to be told they've got terminal cancer isn't quite as upsetting as you might think. I mean, I don't have any great apprehension about the great beyond after I pass. And, you know, the things that I know about the great present are far more interesting, and so I'm kind of reveling in the moment, you know, raising kids and doing all that. Anyway, the one subject that has come up in my life quite a bit, mainly as a result of, you know, the things that I've learned about in science, have been all these very odd things about the human body and the human condition and the physical world. And I've tried rather mightily to sort of integrate them together. And when I do so, I come up with a fairly interesting picture that I think might be not as well known to my theistic friends, mainly because science is not a very poetic language. The other part of the problem is that if you look at brain physiology, those parts of your brain which are activated during religious experiences have almost a direct connection synaptically with your limbic system, which is a system that regulates emotions and all of these things. So religious experiences are often inherently very emotional experiences for the person. If you look at the scientific experience that the person has, those connections don't really meet up with the limbic system very easily. And so to get passionate about science or ideas in science, you have to work at it a lot harder because evolution has not set the stage, you know. So that's why I can give this talk multiple times. And for you, it's going to be like you've heard it for the first time. So anyway, let me begin. All right. As you say, I like doing things extemporaneously, but now I have to revert to sort of the academic format and actually read 31 pages of... One of the first things that I've always been amused by is that the King James Bible basically only has about 700 words in it that have anything to do with the physical world. You know, 750,000 words are given over to talking about the human condition and the human condition in relationship to, you know, religion and things like that. But when you look at actual words having to do with the physical world, it's very small. And so consequently, it's hard to understand as a scientist what it is that the underlying physics is that a document like this, like the Bible, Old and New Testament, is trying to communicate. Many of the words are rooted in very old archetypal understandings of what matter and things are all about. And that's one of the problems, that when you try to fashion the human body from ideas that are many thousands of years old, you have basically limited yourself in speaking about the physical world to ideas that are equally old. If you update to what we currently understand about the physical world, you're going to find a much more enriched idea about what the human form is all about, this sort of thing that we talk about as just, you know, ordinary corruptible matter. And I think I'd like to lead you in to a little bit of a discussion about exactly what the modern idea of this corruptible thing is that we walk around in and, you know, and things like that. If you look at some of the old textbooks from the 1800s talking about the physical world, I don't know why I keep saying word. First of all, matter is going to be defined as anything that possesses extension and impenetrability, as earth, water, and air. Okay. Different kinds of substances that form bodies. Bodies are composed of substances and atoms. An atom is a particle of matter, infinitely hard, infinitely small. When we talk about extension, which is another characteristic of a body, it's a property by which a certain body occupies space. Extension has three dimensions, length, breadth, and thickness. And the amount of space that a body occupies is termed its volume or bulk. These are very intuitive, common sense definitions. You know, nothing new here. Weight is due to the forces of gravitation, by virtue of which every particle of matter attracts every other particle towards itself. Okay, pretty good. By 1900, a couple of new terms entered the common lexicon. Mass. The weight of a body is the force with which it is attracted by the Earth. The mass of a body is the quantity of matter which it contains. It's a measurement of the inertia. When you apply a force to something, mass is a measurement of how hard it is to actually move it under that force. Speaking about space, or historically void, it's an unlimited or incalculably great three-dimensional realm or expanse in which all material objects are located and all events occur. That sounds fine. You might be interested to know that in the 12th and 13th centuries, there was quite a discussion about space and void. And if you look at the earlier discussions, they really got wrapped around the axle about thinking about if you have a body and shift that body, you temporarily produce a void, right, in which there is nothing. Okay. By the 13th century, it was determined that if the existence of the void were logically impossible, not even God with his infinite powers could create such a condition. That became sort of a prevailing idea amongst many of the philosophers of that time, and there was a lot of literature going back and forth about the existence of the void and implications. This led to the condemnation of 1277 by Bishop Etienne Tempierre of Paris, who struck down dozens of lines of philosophical discourse on the void as contrary to church doctrines and an excommunicable offense. Thou shalt not limit what God can do, even to create something like a void or something as what you think is illogical. All right, so they got really annoyed by that. Okay, now time, fairly uncontroversial, and I think we all understand that a little bit, is a duration measured either by natural or artificial means. Principal natural indicators of the lapse of duration are the revolution of the Earth upon its axis. Okay, pretty commonsensical. All right, so as an element of the physical world, when we think of the human body, we think in terms of elemental properties. It occupies space and has extension. It has mass, and in the presence of gravity, it also has weight. It exists over a duration of time. It can be seen and is not invisible. In this realm, science is well designed to circumscribe and articulate human physical properties. This invariably, by those earlier definitions, leads to a largely negative description of the human form. Humans consist of physical bodies, which are gross collections of ponderable, sensible matter in atomic or molecular form. They are fragile and subject to wear and tear. They have to be fed other forms of matter, which are then absorbed into the body as foreign material and digested. Kind of icky. The human body is therefore tainted by all that it consumes. The human body has a limited sensorium compared to many other animals, a poor sense of smell than a dog, worse visual acuity than an eagle. Humans cannot even move freely between land, sea, and air like some birds. that can survive naked in only a very narrow temperature range between 50 and 80 degrees or risk hypothermia and dehydration. No wonder that after thousands of years of being chased by predators and searching for food and shelter, many humans have decided there has to be more to what we are than what we are made from. Okay? I mean, really. Before we consider how modern science has revised our understanding of our world, we have to distinguish among the many so-called different realms of human experience. At this point, I wanted to discuss a little bit about realms and magisteria. Now, I'm not a theologian, I'm not a philosopher. I'm basically your nuts and bolts astronomer. So basically, I have no business talking about these, which are very complicated terms, I understand. But I do understand the gist of it, that you have independent realms of knowledge that humans occupy all the time. The scientific realm, the spiritual realm. We have others that are characterized by folk medicine and folk knowledge, by ancient religions no longer practiced, understandings of ESP and ghosts and things like that. You know, each one of these sort of ways of looking at humans and its human non-physical attributes have their own rules and own languages within them. Okay, the problem is when we try to communicate from one of these magisteria into the other, or decide that one has a more superior understanding of something than the other one does, then we get into the typical human disputes: who's right, who's on first, you know, how tall are you compared to me, you know, these sorts of things. And all of those things get us going in the limbic system, you know, fight or flight, and all of a sudden you can't have a coherent discussion any longer, right? Which is kind of an interesting thing when you think about how brain functions and how we are as humans. Assimilating information really taints the way we process that information and what we make of it. So what, if anything, can modern science bring to this kind of a discussion of these different ways of looking at humans and what we are? Most of the other magisteria, if you want to call them that, are static in time. They've adopted specific traditional languages for describing phenomena within their respective worlds. In some cases, the language is thousands of years old, and for most people, this stability actually confers enormous credibility and respect. This, however, is not the modus operandi of science. Science is fundamentally based on the proposition that it is exploring a world in which new ideas must intrude. The acquisition of new ideas is not seen as a liability and a threat to the status quo, but as the central pathway towards developing a more accurate understanding of the elements that fall within its magisterium. We don't know everything yet, and so we have to be open to ideas, new data, in order to incorporate that into a better, what we hope is, an understanding of things. I mean, we're not just data takers and talliers. We're trying to ultimately understand things that are going on in the world. Adapting the newer definitions and understandings of the foundational ingredients to the physical world, I think that rather diminishing the human experience in the other magisteria might actually allow for a deepening of the theistic experience, if that is what one is searching for. I mean, if you have any issues about the nature of the physical world and you're only thinking about it in terms of the older forms of thinking that are largely pre-scientific, then what I'd like to suggest is that you try to incorporate some of the newer ideas, which I think you're going to find quite surprising and perhaps a lot more within your language set than has typically been within the science language set. In Catholicism, the spiritual realm, if you want to call that, we have the Holy Trinity. We have God the Father, Christ the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And with all due respect, in the scientific realm, we also have a trinity of sorts. We call it matter, field, and space, or more properly, space-time. First of all, I have to apologize. Matter, field, and space are kind of ugly terms fashioned for scientific expediency, not for their innate poetic appeal, which is obviously lacking. Reducing a delightful drive to grandma's for Thanksgiving turkey to a nuts and bolts discourse on engine mechanics and energy conservation is clearly a bad idea if you're communicating in one of these magisteria, but not necessarily in another. Okay. Be it as it may, the new language of physical science is firmly rooted in descriptions of matter, field, and space, In some ways, these have become the new Aristotelian elements, earth, air, fire, and water. Long ago, when only these four elements had been deduced, it was clear that humans were earth, a rather corruptible and contemptible element we shared with rocks, pigs, and snakes. Okay? Hence, the human form, and the physical world for that matter, was only seen as kind of a lower form of existence. With the advent of modern physics, the fundamental elements out of which to fashion a human form are now matter, field, and space. Two of these essential elements, field and space, are completely incorporeal and invisible. And our footprint in the matter realm, if you want to call it that, is actually tenuous at best. After 3,000 years, we have created a far more subtle description of the human form. We have also uncovered along the way some rather curious facts about our human existence as a physical being. We all have a sense of our own solidity and that our hands and bodies are really and actually an integrated whole. Okay. You are the owner of all your cells, and each cell is tagged by the essence, genetic or otherwise, of who you believe yourself to be. That means you should be able to count all of the cells in your body and tie them to essential organs and systems that are part of your integrated being. If we were to count the individual cells in your body, 9 out of 10 would be cells within vast colonies of bacteria and viruses. 9 out of 10, if you count by cells. Only 1 out of 10 cells in your body is technically you. While the human body is made up of about 10 trillion human cells, we harbor nearly 100 trillion bacteria and viruses. So we win in terms of our body mass. Our body mass, that is our cells, is still 98% of what you weigh on the scale in the morning. But we lose in terms of the genetic identity of our component cells. But even among the genetics of the cells, we can definitely assign to a process emanating out of our own conception. All is not numerically simple, as we might hope. We share 96% of our DNA with primates, such as chimpanzees. We share 99.5% of our genome with Homo with the Neanderthal man, putting it in a colloquial. About 98% of our 3 billion nucleotides are non-coding junk DNA, as it was used to be called, that in many ways respond to environmental factors to promote gene expression. Humans have 22,000 coding genes compared to 30,000 coding genes in grapes and 16,000 coding genes in chickens. All right? But that's like limiting what you can play on the same 82-key piano to rock and roll and not considering other musical forms expressed with the same keys, but in different sequences. It's the non-coding DNA that makes this difference. According to McDonald, a researcher in genetics, our findings are generally consistent with the notion that the morphological and behavioral differences between humans and chimpanzees are predominantly due to differences in the regulation of genes rather than to differences in the sequences of the genes themselves. What this means is the human body is not what it is because of genes that compose it, but is what it is because of the symphony of gene regulation that is being performed upon its genetic keys. We are, in other words, a song, not a musical instrument. Okay? It's the regulation of these genes that makes us human. It's not the number of genes we have, because we come out pretty poorly when you look at gene counting. But the regulation in our genes is the vast majority of the information in our genetic code. When you turn a gene on, when you turn it off, a process called methylation, which has an environmental component where genes can go on and off depending on aspects of the environment that the organism responds to. We have been speaking about the physical human form at the cellular level, but what if we go down another few levels to the atomic scale? We've reduced your intrinsic cellular makeup to 10% of all the cells in your body, but 98% of our mass, so let's congratulate ourselves for not having become completely irrelevant at the cellular level. Okay? There's still 98% of us on that bathroom scale that really is us. And we're not chickens, we're not goats, we really are us because of the gene regulation, which is sort of going on. At the atomic scale, a level entirely unknown to the framers of the Bible, one would presume, your body mass, which seems to be dominating the mass of your body, can be reduced to the masses of individual protons and neutrons. A bit of mathematics would show that for every 50 kilograms of body mass, about 110 pounds, you have about 30 billion, billion, billion protons. I didn't just have a seizure. It's 30 billion, 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 right? We've lost nothing in this calculation because when you add up the constituent masses of such a large ensemble of protons and neutrons, you come up with what you see on your Bauterive scale. Okay. Unlike the cellular reduction, there seem to be no new aliens interfering with arithmetic. You know, those are authentic human protons and neutrons that are sort of in there. You know, since the 1960s, physicists have known that protons and neutrons are composed of exactly three smaller particles called quarks. No, that's not the cottage cheese you can get in Germany. These are fundamental building blocks of matter in the physical world. So one obtains about 90, three per proton and neutron, 90 billion, billion, billion quarks for each 50 kilograms of human body mass. We also know something about these quarks. Although they also contain the intrinsic property of mass, they contain far less of it than the protons do. In fact, the three quarks that make up a single proton contribute only about 1% to the proton's total mass in kilograms. If we do a bit of math, we see that for every 50 kilograms of body matter, you only have about 1 kilogram of actual mass. All right. Well, where do the other 49 kilograms go? That really isn't mass in the conventional physical sense. To answer that question, we now have to step away from matter, which was one element of our trinity, and I'll talk for a few minutes about the second fundamental element of our trinity, fields. Okay, at this point, I have a note that says, show magnets. Okay, how many of you played with magnets? Oh, come on, these are, one way, you know, when you have a north and a south together, whatever, they really attract really hard, you know, and when you do north and north or south and south, they push against you like crazy, okay? Can't see that field. I know it's there. I can sense it because other matter interacts with that region of space and it sees something going on there, all right? Magnetic fields are one of the most common fields that the average person knows about by name. And just as I showed, pick up two toy magnets and play with them and you'll sense that there's this invisible thing going on there in the transaction as you're moving matter together. So there's something going on. In the 17th and 18th century, it was thought that magnetism was invisible corpuscular emanations coming off of the matter. We know that's not the case because if you take these magnets, you know, put them in a vacuum chamber where you pump out all the gas, you still have exactly the same magnetic field. So they're not corpuscular. They're not particles emanating from this, flowing out into space. That's just not the model. It is clearly something that emanates from individual elementary particles themselves under certain conditions. So it's a really fundamental thing going on at the particle level. Fields cannot be divided into elementary fragments like rock into constituent atoms. Fields represent an entirely new feature of the physical world that is inherently invisible no matter what technologies are applied to them. They can only be made indirectly visible through their interactions upon other matter. Okay, so they're not even things that are invisible in principle. They are totally invisible, and there's no way you can make them directly visible. You can mathematically model them, but then that's a mathematical model. That's not the thing in itself. Okay. Since the mid-1900s, physicists have determined that fields are not a form of matter. They are formed by the collective actions of what are called virtual particles. These particles cannot be directly observed by any physical means whatsoever. They are not only invisible, but there is no physical agency we can use to make them visible in transit and before they have had their effect on material particles. For instance, virtual photons exchanged between charged particles produce the electrostatic force that they feel, and also under conditions, other conditions, magnetism that we feel. Physicists have specific mathematical theories rooted in specific experimental findings that describe fields, their virtual particles, and all of their possible interactions. There are three elementary fields in nature, electromagnetic, and the two nuclear forces, the strong and the weak. These fields produce forces as a consequence of the exchange of the virtual particles. Okay, and you can think of these virtual particles as like a buzzing swarm of bees surrounding the object. Here is a corpuscular model, but these particles are not visible. You can't see the bees themselves, but you can certainly feel their interaction with you at the point of contact. So that's sort of how it works. The electromagnetic force is mediated by what's called a virtual photon, strong nuclear force, which holds quarks together inside neutrons, is mediated by what are called virtual gluons, clever phrase. And the weak force, which causes quarks to change their identity, are mediated by a triplet of particles called the W plus, W minus, and the Z zero. Once again, although the forces produced by these fields can be accurately measured, the virtual particles themselves cannot be detected by any means. Not only are they invisible, but they are not even in principle detectable because of a specific quantum law called the principle of, well, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which puts a kibosh on any direct attempts at simultaneously measuring position and speed or time and space or various conjugates like that. There is only one way in which you can make them visible. When you provide a virtual particle with enough energy, as through collisions between particles, the fields of the interacting particles store the energy temporarily. And if the energy is above a certain threshold, the virtual particles that constitute the field can become real, although they may still be invisible. Case in point, when virtual photons are provided with just enough energy, they become individual real particles called photons, which, still invisible, we experience as light. Okay, and are detected at the point of interaction with your retina. You can perform this experiment yourself each time you turn on a light switch, and you know, we've heard that analogy once today. It's a very powerful thing that these things are inherently, if you want to call them unreal, that's fine. In physics, they're not really particles that are real in the sense of electrons and other things. But yet they're there, they're an important ingredient to the world, and you can actually see what the collective actions of these things are in the invisible characteristics of the magnetic field, which are a manifestation of these virtual particles. So for decades, physicists have been performing this kind of a conjuring trick of basically creating particles out of nothing by merely providing energy to various fields in space. In fact, it's become such an unremarkable miracle in physics that physicists tend not to even mention it as anything of real significance. Each second, accelerators create trillions upon trillions of particles in this way, particles that were never included in the original inventory of the instant of creation, I might point out. The reason that we can do this is because energy and mass are quite the same things. And that was a discovery made by Albert Einstein back in 1905, give or take. And known to everyone by the cryptic formula E equals mc squared, which you can find on the backs of t-shirts and on various Twilight Zone episodes, The general public may not remember algebra, but virtually everyone knows this formula. This is also, by the way, an example of how pure mathematics leads us to concrete insight about the physical world. And this is something that makes physicists and scientists very giddy. And it's often been remarked, why is it that the natural world is so amenable to mathematics? You know, you come up with a mathematical relationship, you go out into the world and isolate a system and you measure these things, and sure enough, bong, 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 bong. Nature cooperates, you know, and the mathematical model pulled out of your head matches up miraculously with the actual data. And if it doesn't, then you basically don't have a very good mathematical model. So you go back to stage one. And it's been remarked over and over again, you know, it's amazing that we live in a world that's that sort of collaborative with the human logical process. Let's take an example, see how it actually works in practice. Take the top quark, for instance. I don't know why I put this example in here. Most of you don't know what a top quark is, but it was postulated to exist in 1973. It was finally discovered in 1995. And because I'm going to give you an example where you actually, you know, calculate masses, I have to use a different unit. We talk in terms of billion electron volts, but that doesn't mean anything to anybody except me and three other people. So we're going to just think about everything in relation. A proton has a mass equal to one of these crazy units. The top quark has a mass equal to 173 of these units. So one of these fundamental particles is about as massive as an entire gold atom. And we created this thing out of nothing, you know, voila, you know, a hat trick kind of a thing. While we actually slammed proton and antiprotons together with enough extra energy to actually create these things. So the point is that these particles were created at the Fermi Lab in Illinois during collisions of protons and antiprotons. The problem is that the two protons have a mass of basically two of these units, and so we needed an extra 344 of these units to actually bring this particle into existence. So where did we get that? Well, we got that from E equals MC squared, because the kinetic energy that we use to slam these together is energy. Einstein says energy is mass, so if you slam these things together hard enough, you make up the difference. And that difference crystallizes out as part of the actual mass of the particle. I mean, I consider that miraculous. I mean, if you want to find a miracle in nature, here is, I mean, how is it that we can do that? How is it that it's that simple? How is it that it's actually controlled by anything that's logical? But it is, right? Nature is even better at doing this kind of a thing on a grander scale, but as far as I can tell, it's a matter of scale, not a matter of technique or new physics. Okay? So long as there is a field somewhere, you can pull real matter particles out of it without limit, so long as you keep supplying enough energy to convert the virtual particles into real ones. So getting back to our story about the physical body, recall that we counted up all the quarks in a 50-kilogram human, discovered that only 1 kilogram of this was mass. It could be tracked to actual mass in a particle. We missed about 49 kilograms. Well, basically, the energy in the field that binds the quarks together in the proton is making up that 49 kilograms. So most of the mass that you see on a bathroom scale is energy in a gluon field. It's not in something that you would conventionally call mass. Only 1% of the human body is actually mass. The rest of it is energy in a field. In a field that you can't see. In a field that you can't even see in principle, because it's a virtual field of particles. It's like the magnetic field that I'm showing you here. So basically, from a simple consideration of counting mass down to the fundamental scale, we've uncovered a miraculous result. As I said, 49 kilograms out of every 50 is actually not matter at all, but it's just invisible energy in fields that are themselves invisible. And once again, this energy is the interaction between virtual particles, which is thoroughly invisible. Pervading all of space from the quantum depths of terrestrial quarks to distant galaxies at the edge of the visible universe is a new field that we think exists. It's called the Higgs field. Unlike all the other fields in nature, the Higgs field has no source. Instead, we think of it as sort of a coloration to empty space everywhere. In this room, you know, inside of a thimble, out at the distant quasar, it's everywhere. Okay. The Higgs field, instead of causing the universe to expand at an accelerated rate, which is what cosmologists say dark energy is doing, the Higgs field performs another miracle. It causes all fundamental particles that are embedded in space to have the property that we call mass. That itsy-bitsy little 1% of our mass that we call grams is actually a gift from an interaction of fundamental particles in our body with this thing called the Higgs field, which is ever-present. Okay. Were it not for this field, all the particles in your body, including the quarks and gluons, would be completely without any mass. And the mathematics says that massless particles can only travel at one speed, and that's the speed of light. So without the presence of this Higgs field in the universe, giving us that little 1% of our mass, our particles would be zipping around at the speed of light. So now we've taken this ponderable, ugly, corruptible human body and converted it one step away from being almost a divine, radiant thing. Now, okay, I mean, take my word for it, you don't even have to do that. This is where 100 years of physics, and I'm just recapitulating it in a couple of minutes. But it's a remarkable thing. In essence, the particles that make up our bodies are basically second cousins to pure light energy traveling through space. And I also want you to think of another thing, that when we track all of this energy back into time, we come to the Big Bang. Okay? The Big Bang was not a moment of darkness. It was a moment of such intense light being created out of space itself that we have actually no word for it. Okay? All the particles were massless at that time. All the particles that constitute things in our world lost their mass by the time we get down to the Big Bang. And so everything was radiant energy. Everything was pure light. Electrons, quarks, protons. Protons weren't there yet. The fields upon which we're composed have an extension in space, and we have a robust sense that there's a difference between self and other. We have a boundary that we can think of about our bodies. Surely there's a hard boundary between that which is the bundle of fields that we're made out of and the vast spaces beyond our physical forms. This turns out not to be the case either. The idea of self and other is in fact not an a priori fact of our existence. It's made real by specific brain regions that we possess and probably share with many other life forms as well. There's a specific brain region that controls our sense of boundary in space called the posterior superior parietal lobe. People that have strokes or epileptic seizures in that part of their area of the brain, which is a physical area, they have a sense that they're timeless, that their consciousness occupies the entire universe. They have no sense of physical locality. They have no sense that this book is different from my corpus or my consciousness. Everything is imbued with a consciousness. Everything is imbued with self. And that's what happens if you deactivate this brain region. That brain region generally is turned on all the time because we're actively in the process of assimilating information from our sensorium and deciding what elements of that represent self and what represents the outside world. All right? If you take various types of psychoactive drugs, or if you, not meaning to cast aspersions on religious states, but if you go into a profound, thoughtful, contemplative state, you can suppress the activity in that region, and you will also have this sense of somehow being a vaster consciousness for a moment or being in communion with it. Discussions about physical space, which play an important role both in our mental construction of an external world and the facilitator of a self-other dichotomy, require knowledge provided by Einstein's general theory of relativity. Right? This all has to take place within a context of space and time. And Einstein's general relativity is our masterful theory, which describes how to talk about that in any kind of a logical way that does not require drugs. This theory, largely crafted in one paper by Albert Einstein, merits our considerable respect. It successfully predicted the Big Bang, detailed properties of black holes, gravitational time and space distortion, the fluidity of space-time, and the accelerated expansion of the universe itself. Your handheld GPS device would not be able to give accurate positions were it not for general relativity. You're making a test on this theory every single day that you use your car navigation aid. Mathematics of this theory are difficult and well beyond the understanding afforded by a casual contact. There is, however, only one essential message that we need to consider from this masterful theory, and that is the gravitational field of the universe is just another name for the older ideas of space and time. More properly, space-time. In other words, space-time and gravity behave as equivalent concepts within physical theory these days. Essentially, the force of gravity is not a true force. It's merely a condition in the local geometry of space-time that determines the paths taken by bodies or energy embedded within that geometry. Matter and energy, in essence, generate space-time and gravity. If you eliminated all forms of free energy and matter in the universe, space and time would cease to exist. Go away. You would definitely have to submit an EPA impact statement. according to Einstein, 1920, space-time does not claim existence on its own, but only as a structural quality of the gravitational field. This ought to be carved somewhere, or at least tattooed on somebody. The idea that it really gets you to think, like space and time, we think of these things as being really robust things that we can measure in our world. But if they're just conventionalities in the gravitational field of things in our environment, then it's sort of, you lose your anchor completely. Because now you can't talk about the gravitational field of anything being different than space and time, which you're already talking about with clocks and meter sticks. This revolutionary idea in 20th century physics, it's now over 100 years old, will turn out to be the cornerstone to a radically new understanding of the nature of space itself. But in its radical departure from older ideas about gravity, Einstein's viewpoint sounds a lot like the old philosophical discussion of the void, which emphasized that without bodies, place, and therefore vacuum and void, could not exist. If we consider that all bodies produce gravitational fields, we see that Einstein's general relativity arrives at nearly the same conclusion, that if you remove body, then space itself vanishes. The intuitive idea that something must serve as the foundation for space, and space-time for that matter, is powerfully seductive, and one to which virtually all physicists, when caught off guard, will swear allegiance. They do so for the simple reason that to do otherwise leaves their mental constructs of the world literally hanging in midair. When we write our matter and field equations that depend on time and space locations, we consider this coordinate grid to exist in some more fundamental way than the particles and fields and energy they are meant to locate in space and time. All right? We think that time and space are, you know, if we talk about where the planet Jupiter is right now, you know, we think about it in terms of time and space positions. We don't quibble that we don't understand where time and space come from when we locate something in this manifold. We think of these coordinates in much the same way that Newton thought of absolute space and time. But there is nothing more fundamental than space-time itself, and there have been tests to look for that, and they have come up basically empty. So to recapitulate our modern understanding, most if not all of our physical forms are energy stored in elementary fields, which themselves are embedded within the fabric of a cosmic gravitational field. And so I have a couple of comments here. One by Steven Weinberg, the essential reality of the physical world is given by a set of fields and the quantum dynamics of those fields. Translation, at its most elementary level, the physical world can be logically and experimentally reduced to the behavior of fields embedded in space and the way that those fields interact. Einstein also made the comment that the material particle has no place as a fundamental concept in physics. Gravity, as a field theory, must also deny a preferred status to matter. That there is matter, we focus on it because we're made out of it, but it's not the fundamental element of the universe. The fundamental element of the universe is something that has to do with space and time. That's the plenum. That's the fundamental bedrock of everything. That everything has to be related to. The existence of a field, existence of a particle, has to be related to some aspect of space and time as a geometry or some other thing. And then we have John Wheeler. What else is there out of which to build a particle except space-time itself? Heinrich Hertz mused about the tendency that we have to bring in invisible things all the time. We're talking about virtual particles. In his book, The Principles of Mechanics Presented in a New Form, in 1894, he said, if we wish to obtain an image of the universe which shall be well-rounded, complete, and conformable to law, we have to presuppose behind the things that we see other invisible things. We have to imagine confederates concealed beyond the limits of our senses. And that's largely what we have had to do. These invisible confederates are the virtual particles that constitute basically almost 100% of our mass, or what we call mass. And so, you know, now we've reached this point where the physical world has been reduced to fields and empty space, and from some other ideas, even empty space itself is not empty, but it's in the process of curvature and doing interesting things. So the connection between humans and the world becomes very intimate and very foundational. You know, it's not where this impure matter that's corruptible, that's sort of laying around in, you know, with space and time going off into eternity, but we're actually embedded in this thing even more intimately than a fish in water. Beyond that, we have, in consideration of the nature of human beings, it is widely accepted that we owe the very existence of our physical form to the pre-existence of specific laws of nature, populations of fields and particles moving about in space-time. This leads to the inevitable conclusion that the preponderance of our physical matter, if not its entirety, is actually energy stored in fields, which in turn are virtual particles, which are unseeable and, in principle, undetectable directly. Rather than thinking about the physical world and our corporeality as substantive and corruptible, it's far better to recognize that our world is dominated by incorporeal fields in space with matter as a trace impurity. This leads to sort of my own personal revelation about what I am in sort of different ways. In my mind's eye, I see a vast landscape of fields busily curving space-time and steering the motions of matter. Beneath this, I see ghost-like things that scurry around, knitting the void together, suspending it like a spider's web above the great abyss of nothingness. I feel the hardness of my body and the ground beneath my feet dissolve away into the invisible gyrations of curvature and in a seamless way reuniting my body with the void itself. My substance is taken up by the energy of these hidden fields, themselves dissolving into the comings and goings at the foundation of space-time itself. Within the mysterium of physical science, the human body has truly been replaced by a song played upon the keys of the invisible fields in the universe, not corruptible matter. And that, I think, is enough of that. Thank you.